Hi, I'm Simone Maben, a physician, a graduate of the Air Force Academy, a professional athlete, and a certified personal trainer. This is a podcast about living a healthy, fit, and balanced life 365 days a year. About a week ago, Joe Rogan did an interview with Michaela Peterson, and Michaela Peterson started something called a carnivore diet, and through this two-hour conversation that they have, which I listened to every minute of it, it was very interesting information, but, you know, half the time, you know, when somebody's talking to you and you just wish that they would stop talking because whatever they're saying you just don't agree with or sounds ignorant, but they just keep talking. Well, this was like really happening to me for like 2 hours. Not Joe Rogan, but Michaela. And so towards the end, he, you know, goes in and just says, you know, there's a lot of people out there that just want you to follow their way. They want you to follow their diet, because he used the term that we're all very ideological and they want people to follow what they say because it just reinforces what they think is correct, what they think is correct. And that got me thinking a lot about why that's one of my number one issues with a lot of people that come out with generalized diets that we also call fad diets, or why they come out with generalized workout plans or platform systems that don't exactly work for everyone. They're looking for this validation, I think. I think it starts off with you truly want to help people. But if you truly want to help people, you'll give them the tools to make decisions and go about things within the way that their world is set up. As we all know, our lives are not set up the same, or things would just be so easy. But that is really the point of me starting this podcast, is bringing truthful topics, information in a way in which you make decisions. And so I have obviously strong opinions about things, but the opinion is based on my interpretation of things. So I truly accept that. In the end, you may just say, I read this as well, and this is my interpretation, I disagree. And of course, if you give me substantial information in which you just disagree, okay, well, we just agree to disagree. But, I mean, that very rarely happens. I mean, I don't have strong opinions about things that don't have substantial evidence around them. I could go on a list of those things. If you can give me reasons that, you know, things don't work the way that we thought, then that's just the way it is. But a lot of things out there are really people looking for validation that what they think works is right. And then, of course, that dollar. They want to make the money based on people wanting an easy way. Just follow my way. It's the way. I just don't believe that. And man, that interview really touched me so much that it's actually going to be the first topic that I discuss in this episode. We're going to really go in on the carnivore diet. We're going to discuss that interview, Michaela Peterson's views and comments on things about her experience of rheumatoid arthritis and being on this very restrictive diet. The second topic we're going to discuss is how to travel and still employ healthy habits. I know that's a really common thing, whether you're doing it for business or for personal reasons. And then we're going to talk about how to choose a training split that works for your fitness goals. If you like what you hear today, please subscribe, like, or favorite this podcast on your listening platform. Please take time to leave a review on the Apple Podcast. These opinions do not represent my employer or any associated partnerships. None of my opinions should be considered medical advice. Joe Rogan is a comedian and knows a lot about the health and fitness industry and started a business, and he has this awesome podcast and YouTube channel where he discusses all kinds of topics. And on August 30th, he hosted Michaela Peterson on the podcast and the YouTube channel to discuss her carnivore diet after years of dealing with her juvenile idiopathic arthritis. And so Michaela Peterson, some may or may not hear, she's Canadian. She's a son of Jordan Peterson, who is some professor, and he's written lots of books and has a political stance, has given lots of talks and been in kind of that line of things. And so I think she's 26 years old or in her 20s. And so she was selected to be interviewed by Joe Rogan primarily because of this controversial diet, the carnivore diet, which is exactly what it sounds like. You just eat meat. And so let me just state that this was like the most painful 2 hours to listen to a discussion or interview in my life. And not because of Joe Rogan. I think he asked very good questions. And I think there were some comments of like people below saying attacking her. He didn't attack her at all. He would just ask her very pointed questions about, so why do you believe that? Or what were the effects? Or why do you do it this way? And there weren't a lot of really good answers, or they just didn't make sense. And so I want to analyze a little bit of the conversation that was said, give some of my thoughts about the comments that she made and her perspective on things, and then some general takeaways. And so a little background on her. So Michaela Peterson said that she was diagnosed when she was young, which is typical of this disorder. Juvenile idiopathic arthritis is when the immune system attacks itself. It's an autoimmune disease. And so she was diagnosed quite young and had extensive joint disease, which is also classic of this disease. So it by no means is super rare, but it is a very unfortunate disease. Obviously, if you have children that are getting joint replacements, which she also had as an effect very young. So she has a true disease, true diagnosis, which is not that rare. But she, in her research, was finding ways to control her symptoms, which is very common for people with any diagnosis. I was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis when I was 24 at the Air Force Academy. And it's quite unique because you either have juvenile arthritis in your kid, or you get it like in your 40s. It's kind of classic. And then here I am kind of in my mid-20s when I got diagnosed. It was kind of classic rheumatoid arthritis. All the blood tests showed it, full inflammation in all my joints, a lot of pain, and I mean, it's just classic. There's nothing really that separated the disease from anyone, except that it was just a weird age that I got it, and we kind of don't know why I got it. Lots of theories, whether or not it was a certain medicine I was taking, or stress, or whatever. There's some genetic connection there, and forever I didn't know anyone in my family that had any autoimmune diseases on both sides, quite healthy. And then unfortunately, I had a cousin pass away recently, just in her 30s, and had very severe lupus, which is also an autoimmune disease. And so there clearly was some genetics in my family that I just didn't know about until she started dealing with hers kind of later in life as well. And so I was diagnosed at that age, and I was already interested in medical school. And so I started doing a lot of research on what could make me feel better. This is what everybody, if you have autoimmune disease and you're listening right now, you know that's exactly what you do. I mean, we spend hours and weeks and days and our whole life researching, why do I have this? What can make it better? What symptoms? I mean, that's a lot of the interviews I've done have asked me that. What did I do to feel better? And so it's no surprise to me that Michaela Peterson, being a victim of this horrific disease, sought out ways to make herself feel better. Her focus was the diet, because she was on a lot of medication she didn't really like. She, to me, they weren't that really unique or crazy medications. I mean, she was on things that I've heard of before and things I don't think that are, you know, quite abnormal for the diagnoses that she had. But of course, all of us don't want to be on medications unless we need to. So her goal was to not only decrease the medication she was taking, but also improve her symptoms. The number one symptom she was dealing with, besides like the joint pain and swelling and stiffness and immobility at times, which are classic of any, especially inflammatory arthritis, which is different. Osteoarthritis is not in this discussion, to be clear. Inflammatory arthritis is an autoimmune disease that is not degenerative disease like an osteoarthritis. So if you have that, please do not think that any of this discussion of this particular part of the podcast pertains to you. People get that confused all the time, and I don't want you to think any of this has to do with osteoarthritis, which is degeneration of the joint. So anyway, back to the point. She found that a lot of food she ate were exacerbating or making her symptoms worse. And so her skin problems and her digestive tract and her mood, depression was a huge thing that she discussed. And so she read and searched, and she found a person named Charlene Anderson, who only ate red meat for 18 years after being diagnosed with Lyme disease. I think I need to do another discussion on the diagnosis of Lyme disease. This isn't the place for that. So after she was diagnosed with this very obscure disease, she ate red meat and got better. So she said, oh, after eliminating all these different things, which was like an hour of the discussion, so I'm not going to go into each step she took. You can go, read her website, which of course she has one. Ugh. So you can go and read what she did to eliminate things, but essentially she got down to the point where she's basically eating nothing except meats and greens. And she said, quote unquote, they were eating this because they didn't realize you didn't need greens to survive. Okay. That's essentially her response to Rogan on like why they were eating greens still. Okay. So her personal belief is that you only need meat to survive by that statement. All right, whatever. So she would eat 2.5 pounds of beef a day, super fatty beef. Her preference was like ribs, and other things that had a lot of fat. She said 80% of her calories a day came from fat. She would allow only two other things in her diet. Tallow. Tallow is like beef made fat. It's mainly made up of triglycerides. They used to use it to make fries at McDonald's, ironically, until like 1990 when they went to vegetable oil. So now you don't see it that much unless you try to buy it. And then she drinks Perrier water because she likes the bubbles. Other than that, that's like all she eats. And I think she's done this for about a year now. And she noticed that when she went to this, a lot of her symptoms were controlled. All those I listed earlier, like her inflammation, her GI symptoms, her depression, everything's been better controlled. And so, I mean, she just had crazy symptoms whenever she would just try to integrate anything back in. And so she just has stuck to this, her and her dad. And she just found that by limiting all of those other foods, like different food categories, that her she felt better, so that's why she wanted to stick to it. Now, some of my criticisms about the answer she gave, just the answer she gave, I'm not even going to criticize anything that wasn't directly said. When she described her elimination process, there was like a lot of overlapping. So she would just take out entire food groups at one time and say that she felt a little bit better. I felt 20% better when I took out these items. And then she would reintroduce them like in really extreme ways. So she said, Sour Patch Kids was the first thing she tried when she took out like sugar and gluten. She said, well, it doesn't have gluten and it doesn't have all these other soy in it. So I tried Sugar Patch Kids. Well, in the medical field, there are needs for elimination diets and certain diagnoses. And anybody will tell you when you try to reintroduce items, number one, you do like very small amounts, and you don't go extreme like processed candy, which isn't even like natural sugar. So, of course, she had inflammatory symptoms that lasted 24 days, and it just wasn't, it didn't sound realistic to me. It didn't sound like she did a very controlled elimination and reintroduction pattern. Another example she used was she tried to reintroduce soy. So, to make sure she had enough soy, she ate like a meal that had gobs of soy in it. So, tons of soybeans and her own miso soup. And this just listed it and basically had horrible diarrhea and all these GI symptoms. And I'm like, I don't know if I would have that if I just ate a bunch of soy. I don't even eat that as a meal. So, why would I do that at one time? And it's been out of your system forever. Just that whole process did not sound like you did a true elimination diet. I will say that in the medical field, elimination diets with foods are typically used in the fields of rheumatology, dermatology, gastroenterology, where foods typically irritate those systems in which those physicians deal with. In talking with those experts in those fields, I have found that none of them have found studies or protocols to follow in which elimination or introduction of foods is done in a very systematic way. So there's no specific way a physician can tell you to do these things. I mean, I've had to experiment myself given my autoimmune disease, and the doctors gave me general guidelines, but they said, honestly, there's not a way to tell you how to do this perfectly. So there's no perfect way to even do this elimination diet. So if there's nothing backed by science and you just kind of randomly do what she did, I mean, I guess maybe that will work for you, but this is completely against what any doctor would even tell you to do in terms of in helping you decide if you truly have an allergy or sensitivity to something. On top of that, she claimed that after she ate that crazy full soy diet, she started having hallucinations where she looked to her brother on in the car and he had like this demon face. Oh, okay. And then she said that she went home and tried to smoke as much marijuana as possible. You know, it was the only way she could like temporize these feelings. Like, I'm sorry, I'm not saying this isn't the place to talk about whether or not you should smoke marijuana. All I'm saying is we know that sometimes marijuana can cause hallucinations, especially if it happens to be laced with something or it's a little bit different. So now you're claiming that you also smoke marijuana as a habit, and in this instance, you chose to like cope with it for the next 2 to 3 weeks until the soy got out of your system by smoking extra marijuana. Like, I don't even know if that hallucination was. I'm not saying you didn't see the hallucination, Michaela. I'm just saying it's unclear of what was causing it. Soy that you had 3 days before, your marijuana habit. I don't know. I mean, just questionable. And then, of course, Rogan goes in and is like, "Are there other people that you've read that have hallucinations from food allergies?" And she's like, "Oh, there's one person that has schizophrenia that has had hallucinations with this item." And then, of course, he already knows the answer. So he's like, "Oh, visual or audio?" And she's like, "Oh, well, it's super rare to have visual hallucinate." Okay, so basically, you're super unique. Got it. Anyways, moving on. So then she talks about the depression that she had was, she continually goes on this point, which I truly appreciate because depression is such a common problem in the world. But she talks about how the food would cause her depression symptoms to be worse, but it was very sporadic, like short frequencies that she went without depression, I would say. Enough to where I'd wonder if that she truly has depression as a diagnosis, and whether it was another psychiatric disorder, or whether that, you know, like bipolar disorder, or if she had dysthymia, which is a low mood that is present for about 2 years or greater, or if she actually just never got rid of her depression and had some better days. What I can say is that chronic disease and dealing with pain causes depression and symptoms as well. So in this particular case where she's trying to differentiate which foods are causing her depression, I would argue that having this horrible disease where you're in pain all the time with joint destruction gives you depression as well. So how is the food 100% causing the problems? I mean, just something to think about. Another item that she states that was hard for me to wrap my head around was that she planned to be on this carnivore diet indefinitely because she just has no cravings. But earlier in the interview, she says that the main reason she tried to introduce all these new foods, because Rogan was like, "Well, why'd you try to introduce new foods if you're feeling so much better?" She's like, "Oh, well, my symptoms weren't that much, and I just had such severe cravings, hence the Sour Patch Kids and the soy items," and she just wanted to go out with her friends. So she would try to introduce these foods again because of cravings. But not right now, she's saying, "I have no cravings on this pure meat diet, so I'm just going to stay on it forever." Okay. So that maybe, I mean, there is something that having increased fat in your diet does help with cravings. I will give her that. But who's to say that this is a long-lasting plan, especially I'm just addressing her, especially what you just said earlier in the interview. Why are you saying that this is, you know, going to be sustainable for you or anyone else? Like, who's to say that the cravings aren't going to come again? And another point, I'm sorry, there's just so many issues with this. So, she makes a statement that a lot of people are still eating grains, and that our bodies aren't meant to digest the grains, and you know, a lot of people would do better if they eliminated grains. We already know that that's, well, I already know that that's a very karma argument that's been around for many years, you know, so that is not new. But the main thing she talks about how people are still eating heavy amount of grains due to them being taught the food pyramid. This is just an unintelligent comment. Like, stay in your lane. Like, you don't even know anything about what people are being taught. First of all, a lot of schools have eliminated health education, so most kids aren't being taught anything about health unless their family is teaching it. And so that, I mean, what are you talking about? Who's even teaching people that grains are in the bottom part of the pyramid that you should be eating? And finally, the number one point is that the food pyramid has been eliminated by the government for several years now. There's a completely new way in which the government has established how Americans should be eat, and it's called the plate diagram. And on this plate, it breaks down what percentage of your food should come from all the different food groups. And grains is not the dominant item on that plate. It's very much more balanced than that. It's can be seen at choosemyplate.gov. You can see this picture of the plate that exists. There's no more pyramid. The government said there's no more pyramid because it doesn't work. And honestly, let me just give a plug for this website because I think it's really, really great for people that need advice for themselves, for their kids, for schools, for programs. I mean, this choosemyplate.gov website is awesome. There is a lot of content and free information there for everyone. Michaela should probably check out that website. Anyway, let's get a little bit deeper in this analysis. So she said that she doesn't know why it's working. Like he said, so why do you think it's working? I don't know why it's working, but people should just try it for 6 weeks. I don't see a downside to it. And then she does Skype consultations. So then, are you getting paid for this? Like, I just have so many concerns that you do not have any background information. This only applies to you. Great if you feel better. Great if you want to try these risks, but you don't see a downside by generalizing saying that people should do this. Like, this is exactly Joe Rogan's point that I addressed in the intro. People just want to be validated by you telling them what they think is correct. So, a few people obviously are going to pay her and obviously contact her because they are suffering. Do not blame you. You're looking for answers to your disease. But I don't think that you should make generalized statements that all these people should do what you do for some random amount of time, 6 weeks, I guess, because it worked for you, when there's not even any other case reports about people doing this. So, I mean, there's a concern with that generalized statement. And then she goes further to say that the physical illness that she had is what's keeping people sedentary. And that's the problem with the obesity epidemic today. And then I mean, I just lost it. Like, are you kidding me? I think Joe Rogan, this is where he lost it too. I think he went like a 5-minute speech about how what she's saying is a generalized statement and how there a lot of people are not, you know, losing weight because of lack of discipline, lacking an ingrained habit. I mean, he just goes on and all facts, totally all facts. But I just disagree. I just disagree because she thought, you know, again, her N of one or person example of one or two, her and her dad had more energy after starting the diet. I'm not telling you didn't have more energy, but not having enough energy to exercise is not a thing. Like Joe Rogan said, do you have enough energy to walk? If you have enough energy to walk to the fridge, to walk to the door, to walk to your car, inherently you have enough energy to work out. That, you know, just these generalized statements not only make her obviously sound dumb. My concern is these generalized statements and lack of intelligence and lack of any kind of training, but then charging people or giving information to co for consultation, you are dangerous. These are the people to stay away from. Like, I can't believe people like this are getting all of this interest from people. Again, looking for an easy way. Oh, it's one thing to do, follow one type of food group. Oh, so scary. But then the little side remarks at physicians throughout, obviously that irks me a little bit. Being a physician, obviously don't like when people say, you know, things against us. I mean, it happens every day, right? Like everybody makes these negative comments about physicians, but she kept saying they could have looked at the diet thing. You know, and she says it with a lot of resentment and anger throughout, like the doctors never looked at her diet. First of all, I addressed in episode one, doctors don't know a lot about diet. They're not nutritionists. So I don't know how they were really even supposed to help you. But at the same time, autoimmune diseases are very complicated. And to know what is causing what when, being a patient that went through that, I experienced that. There's a lot of unknowns. There is, if your te certain tests come up negative or positive, we don't know why you're having things you have. Doctors are humans. Just like how you have a job that you do well at most days and have certain bad days and you try your best to help people, doctors went to medical school. They have some information to help you. We're not God. We're not, magnificent mythical healers that can come up with answers. We do our best to give you what science has already proven worked to make you feel better or heal you or give you answers. Like, literally, we're just normal, humble little people working within our realm of what we know. And I feel like there's a lot of anger coming from her in that the doctors didn't tell her what diet to follow. But there are some other very, logistical things to look at here. You can't run tests. Like she said, she wanted the celiac, test done. First of all, it's a really expensive test, and insurance isn't going to always approve certain tests. So sometimes doctors are making smart decisions to not order tests in the event that that has to come out of pocket for you because there wasn't enough clinical information to support the need for that test. Patients get angry about stuff like that, but if you want to pay for these tests, you're more than. We're more than willing to let you do that, but at the same time, what are you going to do if you get a false positive test? What do we do with that? False positive meaning the test says that it's positive and this happens at different frequencies depending on the test, but then what do we do with those tests? You're not supposed to order tests unless they're clinically indicated in a lot of different parameters. And then only, like I said, only a few people are really comfortable analyzing the different symptoms that you have and the need to go on a special diets and follow special protocols. And so when she makes the comment that, yeah, a doctor really needs to study the carnivore diet, just so many issues. I agree. Doctors can study a lot of different things, but obviously her lack of knowledge about what it takes to actually run clinical studies is affecting, the strength of this comment. There's a lot of loops to go through. There's thing I mean, you can't just put people through experimental studies without getting it passed through a national governing body because you can't put patients through experimental things. You have to have the money to run these tests. Where you're going to get the money from? She just said a lot of things, a lot of anger, like people aren't helping her out, when really the very subjective things she stated her entire interview, everything is subjective. It's to her. It's all relative. She doesn't have a lot of answers about how long to do what. Is well, how do you even study that? You don't even have anything very specific to say. Anyway, this topic really just resonated with me. Being a person that has been diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis and has seen specialists and lived with this, and now also being a doctor and being a person that knows a lot about nutrition. I just have issues that people are following just this generalized, comments that she made. So the takeaway is it's not a good idea to do extreme things, especially with your nutrition, especially if you only have one or two people of examples that this has worked for. So, I mean, I will always stand by, more balanced ways of eating and a healthy approach to things, whether you choose to limit certain items. For health or ethical or other personal reasons is up to you. But I do not stand by fad diets, which the carnivore diet is. These type of extremes are just unnecessary and surely just to set you up for failure. Traveling and staying fit is one of the hardest things to do for people that have it as a habit and for people that are just trying to incorporate new healthy habits. It's just tough. And so I want to give you five tips to follow when you need to travel that hopefully will make it easier for you. One, I think you need to think ahead about your workout. When are you going to be able to get it done based on your travel schedule, especially if you have a flight and your meetings or your time with family or whatever the schedule is on the other end? When are you going to fit in the workout? Do you need to do it before you leave to get on that plane, meaning getting extra? Up extra early, or are you going to be able to do it once you get to the hotel and there's some downtime between the first thing you have to do, or your friend's house and before the next activity. You know, you really need to think ahead because it's going to affect what you do early on in your trip. And then you need to decide if where you're going is going to have what you need to do the type of workout you normally do. If you like a gym, does the hotel or the house you're going to have a gym in it or nearby it? If you're a runner, like to bike or just walk or be outside, are there trails nearby to where you're going? You need to look that stuff up before you go. Figuring it out when you get there is going to make it a lot harder and a greater chance that you won't follow through with it. If you are a person that can make up exercises that are primarily body weight focused, then this is really easy for you. I remember doing like plyometric exercises, which are body weight exercises at an intense level. I remember doing them in a parking lot when me and my friend went to Disney World because there's just no place to work out based on where I was staying, and I just needed to get it done, and I felt great afterwards. So, I mean, I was just being creative, and it also just worked for our schedule, so that was perfect for me. The other thing is make sure you actually pack the stuff you need to work out. I mean, people say, oh, I forgot this or forgot that. You know, if you're going to swim or bike or walk and you need special shoes and you need workout stuff, you need to actually have that stuff prepared in your bag before you go. Not having it also obviously means you're not going to be able to do it. So, for example, tonight I'm flying out to go to a pain fellowship interview in Florida, and I've already decided that I can get the workout in before I actually take off on my flight. And then I already know that my arrival time back tomorrow is going to be enough time to get a workout in afterwards. And so planning to do a workout there isn't going to be necessary. But if my flight was much later in the day tomorrow, I would plan to get a workout in before that. And so I also am going to make sure I have all the stuff that I need to, you know, just to eat well. And so that's going to transfer into my next part because that's really the key. So the number one tip for eating well is to travel with food. Just don't rely on the airport's food. It's not good. What if the place that you want to go to that has really good options is far and you can't make it with your flight connection? Or what if you need to eat while you're in the plane and you don't have that food with you? There's so many variables that can pop in that affect whether or not you get that food, that the best way to secure a chance of success with eating right is to have the food with you. And this way you also save, because we all know that the airport food is very expensive and you have to spend a lot of money on it. So this is one of the few times that I rely heavily on more processed meal replacement items like protein bars and protein powders. I usually have them on hand, but this is the time that I pull them out. For my protein powders, I'll throw them either in a plastic bag into the mixer cup or just in the plastic bag if I know I'm going to have a mixer cup on the other end. Again, takes planning. And then if I'm taking any special pills or supplements or anything, I put them into separate little baggies, whether a powder or their pills or not. I mean, I know somebody that would pack like the whole entire container with them, and I'm like, you're literally going for a weekend. That this makes no sense. And then the cool thing is you come back and you can save those little baggies and throw them in your cupboard, and they're always the same ones you use for those protein powders or supplements or whatever is in your regimen. Just remember that TSA will be p very particular about certain consistencies of items and may ask to look at those things. Powders typically you get by okay, but like I think one time way back in the day I had something like a protein pudding that was confiscated due to the consistency. And things like that. So just be very thoughtful about whether or not things will be confiscated, but even more so that you may be pulled to look at those items. So some items I like to take with me are pretty, I don't know, pretty obvious, I think. And then some of them aren't too obvious because people usually just think processed food. So obviously the protein bars and protein powders are not the best always, especially if I'm getting ready for something where I'm working on my physique and I t tend to cut out those items, then I have to look at actually carrying other things with me. So some good examples are like veggies travel well, nuts, rice cakes. You can put peanut butter on them if you like. I'm just not a big peanut butter fan. I know, weirdo. And I know a lot of people like those, and you can buy little carry packs of that or just put them in a Ziploc bag and squeeze them out. It's the same thing. If I'm only gonna be about an hour or two before I need a meal. I mean, I will take legit meals with me in Tupperware, which travel just fine. You just put them in your carry-on bag or whatever. I don't know why people find this so foreign. If it's in the morning and I'm leaving early, but it's not quite time to eat breakfast and I just, or I'm in a rush, I'll have the oatmeal and the eggs and everything cooked, throw them in a Tupperware, boom, they're in my to-go, ready to go. Otherwise, salads, lean protein veggies, what I always eat, just have it prepared, throw it in a Tupperware. If it's a really cheap Tupperware, you know, some disposable one, throw it away when you get there. Don't even have to carry it with you. One little tip, always make sure you have some type of utensil. See, obviously, I've been caught a lot of times where I forgot this. So you don't have to carry metal with you, obviously. But even if you're in the airport, remember to grab something plastic with you before you get on the flight so you have something to eat it with. The next item is make sure you drink lots of water before getting on the flight and while in flight. So I carry a Nalgene water bottle with me. I make sure I pour it out before I go through TSA. And then I just refill it right when I get through the other side to make sure I have plenty of water with me on the flight. If I'm doing a really quick flight and I'm not carrying a large bag with me, I typically can't carry that 1 liter bottle. So even then I plan ahead and I make sure I drink as much water as possible before I take off and I leave. But once I'm in flight, I'm not shy to ask them for more water. I mean, nobody's going to say no to more water. So that teeny little cup is kind of a joke if you're a person that really focuses on hydration. So just say, oh, can I have a whole bottle? Can I have two? Or just throughout the flight, repeatedly just ask for more refills if for whatever reason they're not giving you the amount that you want. Flying really, really dehydrates you. And on the opposite side of things, sometimes it actually can cause you to retain water if your water salt balance is off. And so flying really well hydrated on the front end is important, but even when in flight, make sure you're drinking a lot of water. Just definitely helps. And then the next item is plan what you're going to do when eating at your destination. So enjoy your trip. I'm not saying going on this trip should be really constraining for you in terms of food unless you have a very specific goal in which you have to stay on a diet. And that's obviously a special situation. And I've been in those situations and I have to pack my food. And, you know, it's more the exception and not the rule, especially for me. It's all about balance. So if I'm going to go on a trip somewhere, I'm going to make sure that even if I'm going to enjoy something really yummy for one of the meals, that the other ones are back on track. Even if I'm eating out with friends or even if I'm going to a special dinner for work, like if I was going to meet with a friend tonight when I get to Florida before my interview, then I would plan, okay, I'll eat really well throughout the day. I'm going to enjoy a really good restaurant when I get to Florida tonight. You know, I'm just always thinking ahead about when I'm going to make those changes. I'm not going to eat crazy all day today, then eat crazy when I'm there tonight, and then eat crazy when I get there. Oh, I have to have the best breakfast. When my friend came in town this past weekend for Labor Day, there was a day that we wanted to go to this really awesome bakery, and we had a donut, which I never have, and it was so special because I was with my friend and I enjoyed it. And then the rest of the day, everything else was really healthy and on point, and I still got to try a new place. She got to try a new place. It didn't mean we didn't even go out to eat the other days, but we just ate really well the rest of the day. So just think about eating at the destination, and if you bring some of those foods with you on the flight and bring a little extra for why you're at your trip, then you always have a backup plan. If you're really busy shopping, you have food in your bag. If you're really busy in between meetings or in between an interview or whatever causes you to be busy, if you bring the stuff with you to be successful, which don't take up a lot of room, might I add, then there's a good chance that you actually will stick to what you wanted to do at home before you got on the road anyway. And then finally, if you're traveling by car, this is the easiest. You literally have no excuse to just not stick to your normal routine. Use a cooler, do whatever you have to pack the food you normally would. The road snacks can be the same snacks you would eat at home. If you're already working on eating healthy and making smart choices, pack those things up in Tupperware. Pack those things up in little Ziploc bags and take them on the road with you. I know a lot of people like to use this as an excuse to get stuff they wouldn't normally eat. I mean, just think about it. You're going to increase the amount of calories you're eating while you're sitting down for X number of hours. It's the perfect storm to start gaining weight before you even got to your destination. Don't even do it. The takeaway, plan ahead and set yourself up for success when you're traveling. Your friends, your family, the people you're working with will be supportive. Don't think about being judged. Don't think about the lack of fun you're going to have. Don't think about any kind of negative effect of making healthy choices. I just gave you a lot of really positive reasons that you should feel empowered to make decisions to do what's right when you're traveling out of town. So employ these. And if you find that if they start to get, you know, more tedious for you, or you just can't abide by what rules you set for yourself, just scale it down. Try to maybe do one or two of these things. There's no reason to try to do all of this at one time. If you do one or two of these things just to start, you're already off to a good start. I received a question from a listener asking what training split would be ideal for weight loss goals. Training split means how often you should lift different body parts throughout the week. And this is a great question, and not only because it's a common question, but because it's really complex. We're going to have to dissect a couple different factors here to get a little bit to the root of it. It's not possible to address everything in this category. There could literally be an entire podcast show on this topic because it is so complex. But I'll try to go through some of the things that I think are most important here. The first thing I'll say is that everybody's body is going to respond very differently just based on their foundational baseline of what they're taking into their body in terms of their diet and their hydration level, how much you sleep, what other toxins you're introducing into your body, such as tobacco, alcohol, other drugs. Also, what matters is how active you are throughout your day, including other forms of exercise besides just weightlifting. What your current weight regimen is and how you're lifting those weights and how you like to exercise is going to be a big part of it, how rigorous or how intense your program is. And then finally, genetics. So these are all variable. So let me go through a couple things that actually aren't variable. What we know is that you're going to burn fat faster the more muscle mass you have. So you can build muscle with different regimens. And that is really what this person is asking, is how do I build muscle that is going to help me burn fat? So let's just make it clear that lifting weights is not building muscle. Lifting weights doesn't mean that automatically you are in this category of people that has more muscle mass, so you're going to burn fat. Now, you will have lots of benefits because exercise and working out is going to decrease the chance of osteoporosis because you're having load-bearing exercise on those joints. It can increase your mood because endorphins are being released from the pure action of movement and increasing your body temperature, and all these other neurotransmitters are being released. And also it can increase your joint stability. But lifting weights doesn't just mean you're gonna gain this muscle mass that actually burns the fat. Now, it's really hard to build muscle. I get this question a lot. It's like, oh, I want to, you know, tone. I don't even know what toning is, but I want to lift weights, but I don't really want to get that big, or I don't want to look like you, which is not offensive at all. Because honestly, I don't really believe you're going to ever look like me because you're not training hard enough. So I'm not offended ever when people say that, but I just find it very, it shows me how much they don't know about how hard it is to build muscle. And this is where personal trainers come in. Personal trainers are going to really hone in on that workout programming and your nutrition planning to make sure you're maximizing all of these things within your control to get to the point to where you are actually building muscle when you lift weights. Now, if you get to the point to where you're building muscle and you want to decrease the fat more efficiently because you've been doing this for a while, this is when you want to start looking at what your training split looks like. There's a lot of factors that go into this, such as how the muscles respond to training differently, whether you have fast twitch or slow twitch, or whether those different muscles have different recovery times, even between people, and even different muscles in the body require different recovery times. So I'm going to give you some general guidelines and what we've found about how different muscles respond to different training frequencies. Now, the muscles that can be trained about 4 days per week are going to be the biceps, the rear and lateral deltoids, which are the back and side of the shoulder, and then your calves. The muscles that can be trained about three times a week are going to be the back or the triceps, and the triceps are the back of the arm. And then muscles that can be trained 2 days a week are going to be your quadriceps, which are the front of the leg, the hamstrings, which are the back of the thigh, your glutes, which is your butt and your chest, and then anterior deltoids, which is the front of the shoulder. So if you're only lifting twice a week, then full body would probably be ideal to where you could target all these muscles. Now, if you can make it 3 to 4 times a week to the gym, then you might end up putting 2 to 3 to 4 different muscle groups together to ensure you target each one, but also then allow for recovery. Remember that recovery is what allows the muscle to grow. At the end of the day, it all comes down to allowing the muscle to recover while at the same time maximizing growth by getting the total volume in to increase muscle size. Volume would increase the frequency, the duration, and the intensity that you're lifting that muscle. So might depend on what how many times you're lifting that. So the reps, how many different exercises you're doing, and how much weight you're doing. So if you're gonna do something where you try to do like a full body workout, just realize that total volume in two total body workouts in a week is gonna require longer workouts or more weight or more different exercises even within one workout. So it's gonna be variable depending on what type of strategy you want to use. Now I'm gonna go through a couple different common strategies and explain a little bit of them to you so you can decide if you want to make any changes to your current regimen or maybe just add something in. So the first strategy would be upper versus lower body, which is exactly what it sounds like. You lift the upper part of your body, your back, arms, chest, and separate that from on a different day doing the quads, hamstrings, glutes, calves. So one of the positives to this is you can increase your training frequency. So you could do this a couple times throughout the week because recovery doesn't take as long because you essentially are not hitting that muscle as frequently, and then the intensity compared to the other styles is not as high. One of the downfalls would be that the upper body workout days would take a little bit longer just because of the pure number of muscles it takes to get through. And so I'll compare this now to another one called push-pull, which is when you're doing different exercises that are either pushing weights or body weight forward versus using actions in which you're pulling things backward and are closer to your body or flexion type movements. This type of exercise is more for intermediate lifters that are used to incorporating different styles of working out, different types of weights. The reason it wouldn't be good for athletes would be that it doesn't require that synergistic movements that you would do throughout a workout. And now I'll go on into the body part splits, which is the typical workout used by bodybuilders or people that have goals of aesthetic focus. And so this is going to be something that takes a lot of time. It can be impractical for some people if you just can't train that pure number of volume throughout the week as you could if you were doing different styles. You have to be in the gym most days of the week if you're going to effectively implement this strategy. One of the downfalls is that there's a lot of load on the joints on this style. There's a lot of energy required. So it's just not for everyone. But you can refine particular muscles because you're going at in a focused strategy every single workout. So that's why you see aesthetic athletes kind of prefer this style because you can fine tune. This would be as opposed to the total body type of workout. Now, a total body workout is going to focus on essential movements instead of multiple variations and the fine tuning I talked about. There for these workouts, there's going to be a slow recovery after the hard lifts, just because you're just training the entire body and you're trying to recover from full workouts. But some of the good things about it is you're going to be able to integrate other training modalities. If you do like to do other things other than lift weights, you can get a lot done, move at a fast pace, and just get it done fast. So it's really efficient. So a total body workout may be great for athletes, and it may also be good for a new weightlifter. So this is a good place to start if weightlifting is brand new for you. These are just some general strategies and some of the most common types. There are others out there, but I tried to adjust the ones that are a little bit more applicable to a general audience. There's a lot to consider when choosing a strategy for you. And I think this gives you some general guidelines to maybe turn up your program if you need to make it a little more intense, or just to make it a little more focused. A lot of people just go to work out and don't have any kind of regimen at all. So if you have questions specifically about what type of program, because this is such a broad topic and it's hard to address in a short period of time, you can definitely contact me and I'd be happy to help you choose the program that may be a little bit more perfect for your goals. Thanks for listening to this podcast on how to live a healthy, fit, and balance life 365 days a year. If you have specific questions related to the information in this podcast, you can email me at simone.maben@gmail.com.